We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Hour 2 of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In just a moment here, we expect that we'll be talking with the author of a fairly recent book. It's just now come out in paper. It was originally published last year. It looks at the history of the euro. Today, the euro serves as the official currency for 16 European countries. It is used unofficially in five others. Supporters of the euro say that it's been one of Europe's grandest success stories. However, there are others who make the argument that the move to the single currency has done little to bring the economies of these 16 nations together. In fact, they say that the monetary unification of Europe is a flawed project and that it will haunt Europeans for years to come. This morning in this hour focus, we'll be talking with David Marsh. He's chairman of London and Oxford Capital Markets. That's a City of London-based corporate finance and investment company. And there, when they say the City of London, that's kind of the thing that we mean when we say Wall Street. He is the author of this book, The Euro, The Politics of the New Global Currency. It is published by the Yale University Press. The book was first published in hardcover last year, and just this past spring, it has come out in paper. So if you're interested in reading it, you should certainly head down to the bookstore. Questions here are welcome as well. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And if you would prefer to send your question along by email, you can do it that way as well. And that is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you certainly should take advantage of the opportunity. If you have comments, questions, you can call us. We do ask people to please be brief, and that way we can get in as many callers as possible. But certainly folks are welcome to call. And Mr. Marsh, hello.
Yes, good morning to you.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Would it be fair to say that you are a euro skeptic, or do you not go that far as to take a position yourself?
Well, I don't like too many labels about these things. I think that I am very realistic about the chances that this European adventure will succeed, and I am more skeptical now about whether or not this will still be around as a project in, say, 5 years than I was a year ago. But I did write the book with a fundamentally skeptical tune because it is really a political project, mm-hmm. and the economics don't always add up. And one of the problems now, and we've seen this so many occasions in the past, but it's now certainly becoming clearer and clearer, is that the political agenda of Europe is out of sync with the economic hopes of Europe. So many of these hopes have been vested in this project.
Mm-hmm. Well, you make, I think, a very interesting point. I'm sure that some people would approach the idea of the euro with the assumption that the intent of this project was, in fact, economic, and that the idea, and it had been an idea that I think people in Europe had thought about for a very long time, even before before the Second World War, maybe even before the First World War, maybe even further past, further back. The idea that unifying the economies would be good for all, that having a single currency would be good for all, and that this essentially was an economic project. And I think you're really making the argument that in many respects, if you look at the motivations of the parties that really made this happen, particularly the Germans and the French, that their motivation was as much political as it was economic.
Yes, I think you've got to look at this in a fairly nuanced way, and you're absolutely right. The project does go back a long time. You could say it goes back to Roman times, because the Romans did, in a way, have a unified empire across Europe with many unifying characteristics, you know, weights and measures. Coins, of course, were also very similar across Europe, but they didn't have anything quite as grandiose as monetary union. But there was an age-old idea that you civilize people by having a common money. But normally, the politics go first. Normally, you unify an empire, whether it's done through scholarship or whether it's done through blood. You unify the empire politically first, and that certainly happened in the case of the United States. You had the Civil War, and then only 50 years afterwards did the Federal Reserve come along. Politics normally goes first and money goes afterwards, and in the case of Europe, it's gone the other way around. And there were actually four reasons, and they're both political and economic, but they are as much political as economic. There was an economic reason to have a single market, to do more trade, so you can tick the box economics there. There was also a political reason of trying to drive on a more unified Europe, so that is firmly a political reason. There was the question of America. America comes into this in a big way. The third reason had a lot to do with America. It was to stand up to the dollar and to show the Americans that Europe was capable of having its own currency, which would be a rival to the dollar, both in a benevolent way and maybe you could say in a competitive way. So that was a mixture of politics and economics. But the other thing, fourth reason, cannot be denied. This was partly to bring the Germans down to the level of the other countries in Europe. After unification of Germany took place in 1990, the Germans looked as though they were forging ahead of the rest of Europe. And so this old idea of monetary union was recatalyzed with vigor and energy to try to make sure that the Germans wouldn't be too dominant. They did have the de facto currency that ruled Europe, the Deutsche Mark, up until when monetary union came in. So the fourth very, very important reason was to keep the Germans in order. And this, interestingly enough, was an objective in which the Germans themselves acquiesced, because they didn't themselves want to be seen as overweeningly powerful and dominant.
Well, to take that point just a little bit further, it seems to be very clear again that the prime movers here were the Germans and the French, and they were very concerned with doing something to perhaps blunt or challenge the power of the dollar. And today the euro is the world's second largest reserve currency. Well, before the euro, the second largest reserve currency was the Deutschmark. Is the role that the euro plays as a challenge or balancing force to the U.S. dollar, is that really so different from the role that the Deutschmark had played when it was the second largest reserve currency?
Oh yes, it is substantially greater because it's a much larger area. It links together, the present euro links together 330 million people. So that's four times the size even of unified Germany. And it is an integrated capital market, and the numbers of euros in circulation in reserve currencies is something like $1.5 trillion. It's an immense amount of money. So the euro as a reserve currency, as a transaction currency, as a global currency, is much, much more important than the D-mark ever was. And the Germans actually never wanted to become the second reserve currency in the world. They knew that it came with burdens, and it came as a poison chalice. So this was another one of the interesting things about the euro. It wasn't because the Germans wanted to become more powerful that they did have a reserve currency status for the D-mark. It was because nobody wanted to hold the dollar on certain occasions. People went into the D-mark, and they drove up the German currency to a level which was sometimes much too high for the good of the German economy. But the point is, as a result of this large currency, which Europe now has, it also becomes vulnerable. It becomes exposed. And you could say, because a lot of foreign banks around the world, foreign central banks, have been willing to put money into the euro, interest rates across Europe over the last 10 years maybe have been lower than they might otherwise have been. And that seemed like good news for a while. But the problem has been for Europe that some of the countries in the euro needed higher interest rates. And you have a one-size-fits-all monetary policy, a lot of foreigners wanting to buy the currency over the last 10 years, not so much now, but certainly when it started, and certainly in the mid-2000s, that actually forced interest rates to too low a level in many of the weaker countries in Europe. They had a bit of a party. Their interest rates were much, much lower than they would otherwise have been had they remained outside the euro, and their economies, therefore, did not have the right level of discipline in them, which is why we are in the mess we are today, because Greece and Portugal and Spain certainly have lived beyond their means for many years, and that's why they are now having to tighten their belts in an extremely painful way.
So that's a point that I'm glad that you raised, and certainly we would get to. You're making the argument, that, in fact, that the difficulties that that those countries are facing, and certainly we've heard a great deal recently about Greece, the difficulties that they're facing, and then the way that that has drawn in the other countries who are in the Eurozone, you think that in fact that's those problems within those countries, Portugal and Greece, were exacerbated by their participation in this?
Yes, undoubtedly. And that was, in a way, the whole point of monetary union. It was supposed to ease the burden on those countries. It made life more difficult for the Germans to start off with. Again, that was totally in the script. As I said, the whole point about monetary union was to weaken the Germans. The Germans acquiesced in this. The problem is that the countries which had lower interest rates than they would otherwise have done, they didn't use the breathing space they gained to restructure their economies and to improve the underlying competitiveness of their industrial structures. They basically went on a consumption binge driven by these low interest rates, not just the government, but often the private sector, and they bought into all sorts of housing and infrastructure and real estate schemes. You had very much a similar bubble of the real estate market in places like Ireland and also in the case of Spain, as you've had in the United States, probably much, much worse. So these low interest rates in certain countries did induce a sort of subprime mortgage crisis, which has been, compared with the size of the economy, is much, much more severe than in the United States. The Germans had interest rates in this one-size-fits-all monetary union, which were higher than would otherwise be the case, so they put on the hair shirt for a few years. But the Germans being the Germans, they knuckled under. They didn't go on a party. That's not what the Germans really do. They didn't go on some sort of binge. They actually got their competitiveness in order. They cut wages in many parts of the economy, not because the government told them to do it. That's not the way it works, because all the thousands of industrial companies up and down Germany simply decided collectively that they were going to tighten their belts. That meant that after 10 years, the German economy has now reawakened like a Van Winkle after a long sleep. It's now an incredibly competitive mood. And the fact that the euro is now somewhat weak on the foreign exchanges is giving the Germans an additional boost, whereas the other countries are actually high and dry. So it's really like when the tide goes out, you see exactly who's been bathing in the sea. And the Germans are now much more muscular, much stronger, much more competitive than they were 10 years ago. They've used the time well. They used the period of their incapacity and their problems very well to restructure themselves. And the other countries who thought that they were coming in for a soft option, they have been pretty unwise and very, very short-sighted. But the tragedy of all this is that it is totally predictable. And many people did predict it, actually, that the weaker countries, after a period of relaxation, would get weaker, and the stronger countries, led by Germany, but also including some other countries like the Netherlands and Austria, would get stronger. And so you do have very much now a two-tier Europe, with the northern countries pretty competitive, pretty strong, quite financially powerful, despite all the deficits that have been building up because of the recession that we've had. So the north, on the whole, is in pretty good shape, and the south is in a mess, and unfortunately will get worse in the next 2 years.
Well, this also leads, I think, to an observation that you make, is that for those people who maybe forecast the coming apart of the Eurozone, they look to the south and the countries that are having a difficult time, and they think, well, if anything's going to happen to make this come apart, it's going to happen there in the south. And I think that you, however, make the suggestion that, well, in fact, that if anybody might actually pull out, that it might well be one of the countries in the north, and the one that you identify would, in fact, be Germany.
Yes, there's no reason, really, for the southern countries to pull out. There's no exit route. There's no process. It's like joining a club where you've consistently refused to pay the dues, and yet the members don't have a means of winkling you out. You know, you'd have to do something really desperately bad for them to be able to force you to leave, whereas the countries in the north could conceivably leave and just split off on their own. I'm not saying that's the most likely chance, but I think it is increasingly likely that that will happen. The important thing is that Germany would never do anything by itself. The whole point about European history in the last 60 years, and the Germans have learned from history, is that they don't want to be isolated in Europe. But they do have allies now. I've mentioned these other states in the northern part of Europe, which have had basically very stable currencies and very stable economic systems with the Germans. They've often not been exciting, but they've done the right things. They've never recorded massive growth rates, but neither have they gone through great cataclysms. These stability-minded countries, there's quite a number of them now. There's Belgium, there's the Netherlands, there's Luxembourg, there's Germany, there's Austria, there's Finland. And then if you go to the countries outside monetary union, you've got two very stable countries, Denmark and Sweden. You've also got Norway, which is a little bit unusual because it's got all the oil and gas. So Germany's got a lot of allies up here in the north before you even start counting Britain and France. And so if the stronger countries were to leave, it certainly would not be Germany by itself. There'd be seven or eight countries which would form quite a decent monetary union by themselves. Lot of power, a lot of trade, a lot of common feeling. And I think it's far more likely that there would be a schism in Europe between North and South than that individual countries would split off. And it would in a way be a rerun of history, like the popes, the poop of Avignon and the poop of Constantinople, which we had at some period in time. That was an East-West split, and it's more likely in this case it would be a North-South split. There's no reason why that would be a catastrophe either, because you could imagine the Spanish and the Italians and the Portuguese and the Greeks still having fairly stable systems and doing quite a lot of trade with each other, and of course still trading with the North, but you'd just have a different exchange rate. And after all, Canada and the United States, they trade with each other without having a fixed exchange rate. Why on earth can you only have one currency in Europe? Why on earth should that be the only precondition for stability and trade and economic growth? It seems to me totally ridiculous to think that you need to have a single currency in Europe to have benevolent trading conditions. It seems to me, and I think the history of the last couple of years has shown this, a single currency can be extremely good on some occasions, but you are storing up problems for the future, and sooner or later those problems do tend to come out and be visible. And the economics always triumphs in the end over political visions, unless the political visions are actually backed up by something really very solid and very fundamental, which I'm afraid to say in this case, they are not.
Our guest in this hour, David Marsh. He's chairman of London and Oxford Capital Markets. That's a corporate finance and investment company in London. He's also a writer, has been a journalist, and is the author of the book, The Euro, The Politics of the New Global Currency. It was first published last year by Yale in hardcover, and now just this spring has come out in paper from the Yale University Press. So if you'd like to read it, you can head to the bookstore and look for it. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, or you may email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call here, Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Well, this is frankly the City of London's point of view on the whole thing, and I think there's a whole line of discourse that's very rarely visited here in the U.S. that I would least like to point the listeners to and have the guest respond to, which is when there was a social democratic government in Germany, drawbacks from my point of view, there was this idea of harmonization up and transfer of wealth to Portugal and Ireland, and a lot of the hoopla about Ireland lowering its tax rate, et cetera, and being friendly to business was the unspoken part of that was this idea of harmonization up, and the project of Europe was to improve the periphery and bring them up to standard, so there wouldn't be this race to the bottom, which is what I see is happening around the world, and many people profit from a race to the bottom, people who control capital, as a matter of fact. So this is not often visited. And, I mean, a lot of the criticism that I was responding to about the European project was the calling it the son of Bolkestein, where the bankers were captains of industry were actually more of dictating and abandoning this idea of harmonization up. We have this bizarre thing now where the Europeans are being more sadomasochist than the U.S. thinks is appropriate for right now, and despite the fact that Obama calls Papandreou and says, you have to cut back more, and now he's counseling people to spend more, which I think is appropriate in a lot of places. And I think that where it isn't appropriate for the polity itself to do it, I think that this previous policy of harmonization upward and wealth transfer from the I know that the Germans are not not going to be persuaded by this at this point, but if things well, anyway, there's a lot there to chew on. And I just there's no authoritative voice on this. It is a political project, and the part of the politics that I wasn't hearing about at all was this this other idea of Europe, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, lots of good points there. First, on this question of harmonizing upwards, i.e. making sure that everybody aspires to a higher standard of living, I mean, clearly that is a very important part of this whole project. People didn't form the euro in order to go into some kind of masochistic bloodbath. They clearly formed the euro as part of an idea of getting greater growth, greater number of jobs, greater amount of investment. And indeed, that did work for a while. If you talk about countries like Spain or Portugal, that also worked for the whole of the 1970s and the 1980s. We've had a tremendous leveling out of living standards in Europe. That's been an unquestionable success. But don't forget that took place without monetary union. This is my point, that monetary union is in some way an irrelevance to this general upwards harmonization. The Germans now have a roughly average living standards compared with the rest of Europe, because, of course, the Germans have become relatively poorer as a result of unification. Unification increased the size of the economy only by about an eighth, and it increased the number of people by almost 20%. So clearly, they became economically poorer. It's taken them quite a long time to recover. That's one of the reasons why the Germans these days are not at all keen on upward harmonization, if that means transferring wealth abroad. You mentioned the Social Democrats. There was a while when there was a finance minister called Oscar Lafontaine who came into power when Gerhard Schröder won the election in 1998, quite a long time ago. And he only lasted for a couple of months because he was much too much of a distributionist for the Social Democrats, who actually are quite conservative. And this lowering of wages, which I spoke about, and the tightening of the belts that the Germans did, came under a social democratic-led government led by Gerhard Schröder in 1998-1999, but in particular 2001-2002. He didn't do that because he's a masochist. He didn't do it because he's against the workers. He comes from the working class himself, Gerhard Schröder. He did it because he knew that Germany's industrial fabric was suffering, and therefore he put into place the conditions under which all these industrial corporations took action to lower wages, certainly in real terms. So you could say, and many critics do say this, that Germany's gone through something of a deflationary period. It certainly got its competitiveness into order. The Germans themselves would say that although they have been tightening their belts and real wage increases have been very, very modest, they would say that they're setting a better fundamental platform for growth in the future from which the rest of Europe would benefit. I mean, that's all really difficult to say what will actually happen. But I wouldn't say this is really a social democratic project or a Christian democratic project. And I don't think this element of a kind of class struggle is really quite as relevant as you're saying. I think this is a German policy, which has been very heavily criticized in some fields, particularly from America, but also from France and Britain, because they are concentrating now on getting the deficit down. And they are still, you might say, relatively masochistic. But don't forget, their deficit is actually 7% of GDP. It's relatively high. So the Germans themselves would say that they've been relatively expansionary over the last 2 years. Just a final point on the banks. Now, I think the banks have behaved absolutely disgracefully over the last 5 years, whether big banks in America, big banks in Germany, big banks in Britain. They've shown themselves to be incompetent. They've shown themselves to be unreasonable in analyzing their own businesses. And they've shown themselves to be rather cowardly in not bailing themselves out, but going to the taxpayers to be bailed out. And compared with the average steel worker in Michigan or the average dock worker in the northeast of London or the northeast of England or the average car worker, let's say, in the outskirts of Paris. The banks have done incredibly well because they've been bailed out by the taxpayers. So I'm certainly not here to defend the banks. But I think it's not right to say the banks have always profited from whatever goes on in Europe. People do lose money when times are tough. People lose their jobs. I'm not saying you should feel particularly sorry for the banks, but of course many very ordinary people who work in banks, whether as porters or receptionists, you know, not just the high-flying investment bankers, have lost their jobs as a result of the downturn that we've had. I think we've seen a great levelling out in society as a whole. But I would say one thing, because we've gone through a very difficult period in Europe, just as we have in America, and because, unlike in America, we're not getting out of it very quickly, there is a huge amount of cynicism in ordinary people's minds up and down Europe, not just in the UK, but in the heartlands of Germany and France, about this whole European project. I repeat, the euro was not supposed to be just a ramp for the bankers or a means for people who are already well off to make themselves even richer. It was supposed to be a means for the ordinary person to profit. And we've had very low growth in Europe in the last 4 or 5 years, and it looks as though it's going to continue to be very low, particularly in the peripheral countries, the poorer countries, the Greeces, the Portugals, the Spains, the Irelands. The people actually need a bit of a boost. And Germany and France themselves, the core, are also not doing very well. So in the court of public opinion, which is, at the end of the day, the supreme arbiter here, Europe is doing very, very badly indeed. And it does mean that there is a lot of resentment and a lot of ill feeling about what this European project has brought, not just from the elites and the people talking on radio programs, but the grassroots of public opinion up and down every high street in Germany and France.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here again. The guest is David Marsh. We're talking about his book, what you will find in his book, The Euro, The Politics of the New Global Currency, out recently in paperback from the Yale University Press. Questions welcome, and we have some others, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, up to Belvedere for the next caller here, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning again, David. I see us going down to Europe's level as far as the economy. It's been sinking for the last couple of years. But I was just wondering, the rumor has it, or should I say the conspiracy theory rumor, is that most countries, there's this group of countries that want us to become one continent currency like European Union has. For instance, Canada and Mexico join us as far as one currency. I'm just curious if you heard that. And if so, do you think the cost of, or the standard of living in America is being drawn down by the rest of the world? And do you see China overtaking America as far as the economic power of the country? I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, first of all, I wouldn't see the point at all in trying to have a common currency between Mexico, Canada and the United States. It would mean that the two richer countries to the north would have to subsidize Mexico very greatly, and I don't think there's any appetite to do that. And I think the lesson of the euro has been that subsidies don't work at the end. I certainly also do think that living standards in America are coming under pressure because of world competition. Now, don't forget, productivity in America is actually much, much better than in Europe. And by lots of measures of living standards, you are doing very well. On the other hand, you do have a huge shadow economy. You've got lots of people on the poverty line. The social security system doesn't work. You've got a much greater prison population than in the area of Europe. So in many ways, your social indicators are lagging behind European social indicators, even though your economic indicators are doing quite well. But clearly, this whole process of worldwide competition, and above all, the emerging markets, the developing countries now demanding that they have a greater slice of the cake, that's going to knock living standards in all our countries. And it's going to mean that we're working harder. You know, we retire much later than in the past. We don't have the feather bedding of the social security system that we have been used to in the post-war period. I think that's unfortunately just part of the reality of the life that we are now leading, and that is because of competition from the developing countries who want a slice of the action. The point about China is that China, on a purely arithmetical basis, if it continues to grow at the pace that it's been growing in the last 10 years, will overtake America just in terms of gross domestic product in the year 2029. But that's just a statistic. After all, you've got 300 million people. The Chinese have got something like 1.4 billion people, falling quite rapidly, and they'll be down to, you know, 1 billion or something like that in 20 or 30 years. So their economy is going to have to be spread around a much greater number of people. And in pure arithmetical terms, the Chinese have been the leaders of the world for about 17 of the last 20 centuries. Nobody really cared too much about that because you didn't have globalized trade. But if you just think of the number of people, it is actually not such an unlikely fact that the Chinese would go back to having, in pure arithmetic, the biggest economy. I don't think that's the same as being a big power. I mean, it could be that the Mandarin as a language will be actually dying out despite all these people in the country because everybody now wants to speak English. That's just one little facet of it. It's one thing having a big economy, another thing how you use your power. The one thing I would watch regarding China is the size of the military, and particularly the Navy. And I think they are now using all the high-tech prowess that they have in many areas of industry to re-equip their military. And no doubt they've learned from America that you don't become a strong country without a strong military. So I would watch individual aspects of the Chinese economy very much. On the other hand, you do have to say that China is undoubtedly has got the potential to become a much more stable country because they are making some progress towards diminishing this huge divide between the city and the rural population, which, as we know, has been the cause of so much unrest and strife in China over the years. So you could say, and I think I would be optimistic on this, that China will be a slightly more stable and slightly more neighborly country with a strong economy than it might otherwise have been. But, of course, the big question, which I'm not capable of answering, is whether they will give up authoritarian, undemocratic, one-party communism. We've always thought that's what's going to happen as they become richer. It could be that you will have authoritarianism and communism on the one hand and a richer country coexisting in a way that many of us thought was impossible. That is something which I simply cannot answer, but that must be one of the big, big questions to at least debate about China in the next 20 years.
All right, let's go on. Another caller here in Urbana, here where we are. This is line two. Hello.
Hello. I regret I have not been able to follow this as closely as I should like, but I think I heard you say there had been a great leveling off in the economy. And I should like to know what you meant by that when all of the statistics show that here in the United States, the discrepancy between the middle class, the lower class, and the upper wealthiest has become even more disproportionate.
Yes, I think we've been talking about two different things. I think you're right that within individual economies, the gap between rich and poor in all our economies has widened. But what I meant when I was talking about the leveling off is that the gap between individual countries has become smaller, but just at a very average level. So the Germans, having been well ahead in terms of living standards per capita in the, say, in the 1970s or the 1980s, other countries are now caught up on a purely average level. The Portuguese are still poorer than the Germans, but by a great deal less than they were before. The Irish have more or less caught up. I think the Irish are actually statistically ahead of the Germans these days in terms of living standards. But I think you're absolutely right. Within economies, there's been a polarization between rich and poor, which has been one of the great failures of market capitalism in the last 20 or 30 years. And that will undoubtedly get worse, I believe, in coming years because of globalization and because of greater competition and the fact that the job losses that we see in many, many industries do tend to hit the poorly paid first more than they do the more highly paid. Although I think it's dangerous to make generalizations, but this leveling off within economies has not taken place, so you're absolutely right there.
The other point I should like to make is your statement that the Social Security system in this country has been a failure. That's absolute rubbish. You must have been reading much too much of our ultra-right press. It has been a success and could easily be reformed to go on infinite.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry if I made a misjudgment there. You are obviously much better informed than I am about the Social Security system. I simply say that there's been a lot of debate, which, of course, we picked up over here on this side of the pond, going back to President Clinton about reforming Medicare and so on. And there seems to have been failures in the Social Security system to the extent that many people are outside the benefit net. But I withdraw my comments unreservedly. I didn't mean that the whole thing has been a failure. What I meant is that there have been failures in the system because many people are living outside the benefits net.
I want to thank the caller. We just have about 10 minutes left here and continue our conversation with David Marsh. We're talking about the euro, the subject of a book that he's authored, The Euro, The Politics of the New Global Currency. It's published by the Yale University Press, just recently has come out in paperback. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. A little earlier, we talked about what the motivations were, particularly for the French and the Germans in the movement towards the single currency, and that they were as much political as economic, and that as far as the French were concerned, one of the things they were concerned with, and I'm sure other people in Europe too, was the power of Germany and of a united Germany. So what they were interested in was bringing the Germans into the fold and, in a sense, putting some limit on their influence. Now, at the same time, it seems that the French were also, they had been concerned with the kind of influence that the German central bank had and felt that they were maybe much too conservative in their monetary policy and thought that if a European central bank was created, it would be, its control over the money supply would be a bit looser. Did they in fact get what they wanted?
Yes, well, I'm glad you put your finger on that point because it's all quite ironic. It's still a bit too early to say exactly how it's all going to work out, but it seems as though the Germans have thwarted the plan of allowing the European Central Bank to somehow come under French control, because the European Central Bank has actually been set up in the image of the German Bundesbank with the same sort of independence and the same sort of haughtiness well above politics, and they have been following a relatively strict policy. And many people in France thought that the ECB should have been turned into some kind of political tool to influence growth and to help more expansionary policies, and they have been very disappointed. And all French presidents have been disappointed, whether they're called Mitterrand or Chirac or now Mr. Sarkozy. But I think the jury is still out because the ECB has been intervening now on the money markets to prop up the bonds of weaker euro states. That's something which the Germans said before, well, more or less over my dead body. So the ECB has become more interventionist and clearly is being driven by a certain political agenda to rescue the euro. The ECB is no longer a purely economic animal. It's certainly got a political agenda as well. So you could say just in the last few weeks, the ECB has been changing its colours. And the head of the Bundesbank has said he disagrees with some of these policies, the buying up of state paper issued by the weaker countries. And that's a sure sign that things are not going totally according to the German plan. So I think it's honours are fairly even at the moment. I think I would hazard a guess to say that if the ECB was under pressure to turn into a dramatically new kind of animal that would not give the same priority to beating inflation as the Germans had done in the past. That would be one more reason for the Germans, together with a group of other like-minded brethren from the north, to say, look, I'm terribly sorry, but this is not the system we signed up for. We're going to go away and form another system. But it's going to be quite a difficult political battle, I think, on that point in the next few years. I do think the whole Franco-German engine is the clue to all this. At the moment, it's very difficult really to say who's winning and who's losing out of that pair.
We now you have said all along here that there, and I'm sure there are other people who would agree that there are some questions about just what is the future of the Eurozone and of the euro. But having said all that, I wanted to ask about the UK, about Britain, and whether, in fact, assuming that the euro continues, whether you could imagine any circumstances under which the Great Britain would adopt the euro.
Well, the only circumstances under which we would adopt the euro would be straightforwardly economic ones, and it would be that our economy was doing hopelessly badly compared with the rest of Europe. They would really have to be showing a winning streak, growth, employment, prosperity, investment. All those indicators would have to be showing a really good positive performance, and ours would have to be the opposite. We would only join a winning team, and I think the British would be quite pragmatic. If we thought that they had a much better system than we did, then we would join. We'd give up the Queen's head on the banknotes, all that kind of thing. But the problem would be that the conditions under which we would go in would be dramatically bad. And I'm not sure that the other countries would really want us under such circumstances. Also, we would want to go in at a very low exchange rate, very low interest rates. We would be actually pretty awkward partners for the other European countries. We're not going to join out of ideology. We'd only join out of economics. But I don't see the economic constellation really moving into shape. The British economy is still going through difficulties, but we have certainly benefited from having exchange rate flexibility in the last 4 or 5 years. And that's really an economic issue. Now, politically, the British have always thought slightly differently from the rest of the Europeans, but we still do a load of trade with the rest of the Europeans. Britain is still by far the biggest trade partner of the 16 members of Monetary Union. But I do myself think it's extremely unlikely that we will join any time in the next 15 or 20 years. And I'm absolutely convinced that over that period of time, the euro will change out of all recognition. It will no longer be the same as what it started. In fact, I think in the next 5 years, it will change out of recognition, let alone over the next 15 or 20 years. So Britain will remain a sympathetic bystander.
We have another caller here, someone in Chicago. Let's talk with them. Line number 4. Hello.
Someone said there's no authoritative voice in these matters, and it seems recently, I don't know if you ever heard of the Banks for International Settlement. Well,
this is
our former Secretary of Treasury Paulson, who negotiated the bailout of the banks here in America and somewhat in Europe, is now part of their board of financial stability control, and it seems their intent is to have an international currency. And I don't know if you'd heard about that, because it was brought forth in some other authors researching the matter, and a book, Crisis by Design, pointing out who's behind the wizard's curtain that's pulling the strings. And so there may be, as he implied, we have our Federal Reserve, the International Monetary Fund, central banks and world banks, and to the extent that they are now going to be somewhat managing, controlling the future international currency.
Well, I think it's all very unlikely. I mean, I don't know who's put around these rumors, but ideas of an international currency, they've been going the rounds for a couple of thousand years. I think we're further away from it than we ever were in the past. I think the dollar is still going to be, despite all its blemishes, the number one currency in the world. And I don't see the Europeans and the Asians and the Africans all kind of teaming up and joining the Americans anytime soon.
We're coming down to the point here. We have maybe 3-4 minutes. I'm interested in going back and perhaps having you talk a little bit more about that, the place where you left off before we took this caller, and talk a little bit about the future, what you think is likely to lie ahead. It sounds as if you're saying you're not thinking that the euro is going to go away, but that in maybe as little as 5 years, it would be something very different from what it is today. What exactly do you have in mind?
Well, I think it's perfectly possible that you could have two economic and currency units in Europe, and I think that would be perfectly legitimate and also quite a stable setup. It would be a bit of a shock while you manage that, I would say. The alternative would be for the Germans really to start to take control of states like Greece and Portugal, and that's exactly the opposite of what countries wanted. They didn't want to join the euro in order to come under some kind of control system run by the Germans. They joined the euro to get away from all that, basically. And also, the Germans don't want to control Greece or Portugal. The Germans now do 10 times as much export trade with China every day of the week as they do with Greece. And the gap is getting bigger. The Germans see their future with Asia and with the fast-growing countries of Latin America or with Africa, they go on holiday to Greece, but they certainly don't want to go down there and run the fiscal office. They've got better things to do. So that's why the conspirators who say this is all just a plan for the Germans to take over Europe and they're sending in their emissaries and so on, are not right, because the Germans want to perform a service in a multipolar world, a service to themselves of growing strongly through exports. And that's what they're going to be doing. And they will be 20 times more interested in doing business with China than they will be in doing business with Greece. And that's where they're putting all their efforts.
And are there other countries that are really, let us say, queuing up to join? And in fact, if there are, would the rest of Europe be that keen to admit them?
Yes, well, Estonia is joining. I mean, that's a very good country, very plucky citizens, full marks to Estonia, I say. But this is not going to change the future of the world that the Estonians are giving up their currency and joining the euro and becoming the 17th member. The big country like Poland, with 38 million people, were Poland to join, that would make a difference, because they are a big, quite successful country. They're the only country in Europe that actually grew last year. Their economy actually expanded. The only country in the 27-nation European Union that had positive expansion last year. They are not in a hurry to join. Denmark is not in a hurry. Sweden is not in a hurry. So I don't see any big country joining the euro anytime soon, because they feel that they are better off outside and they don't want to join a team that looks somewhat ragged and where there's no real captain and where the manager of this team doesn't quite know where the whole team is going or even whether they'll be playing on the same football field in a couple of years.
Just overall, if you look at the project of European economic unification and those things that were promised, were the desired goals, can you, and I guess this goes back to the early part of your book where you say, well, essentially you say, you can make a strong argument both ways. You can argue that it was great. You can argue that it was something that Europeans will come to regret. But how do you come down on that?
Yes. There have been some very good points about the euro, but I think the fundamental fact is that the countries that should have used that time that they gained through the euro to do positive improvements in their economies, they failed to do that. And this was a major mistake. And the countries, let's say in the north, that should have been forcing those southern countries to put their houses into order, they failed to do the right analysis and they failed to use their political judgment in order to set a much firmer foundation for the euro as a whole. So we're now revisiting this whole theme more than 10 years after it started. We're now looking at the conditions for making this a durable success. And it's far more difficult to do it now than it would have been 10 years ago. So this has been a story of grotesque failure of human and political judgment. It's been a story of moderate success in terms of the short-term economic growth that the euro has engendered. But there has been a party going on, and as we all know, parties come to an end sooner or later, and everybody's waking up with a hangover. Mm. It's much more difficult to cure yourself when you've had a good party rather than if you'd always been remaining rather sober all along. So there has been a huge amount of waste, I would say, over the last 10 years. And everything is much more difficult as a result.
Do you expect, should one expect that the new British government, relatively new British government, that economic policy is going to be significantly different from what had gone before?
Not really, no. I think they are making an effort to cut the deficit. Now, all new governments do that, but I think it's a fairly middle-of-the-road government, actually. I don't think it's particularly brutal. I don't think it's particularly wildly talented. I don't think it's going to be particularly successful, but also I don't think it's going to be much of a failure either. So I would say to all the Americans listening here, continue to come to England. You won't notice that we've changed that much.
Mm. And again, as far as what's going on in here in Europe in the South, that is the literal and metaphorical South, where do you look to see how things are going to go here now over the near term?
Well, I think Spain is the key country, and I think I'm actually relatively optimistic about the Spanish because they have done wonderful things over the last 30 or 40 years, the Spanish, to come out of the Franco dictatorship and become a modern economy. So I think if you look at Spain, you might say, well, perhaps the glass is fractionally half full rather than half empty. I think the Greeks are in a mess, and the Greeks will have to default on their debts, reschedule, reorder their debts in a couple of years, and then there'll be the question whether they do actually remain in the euro after that. But I think it's going to be quite a long-running play, and anybody who thinks the euro is just going to come to an end in a huff and a puff of smoke, they've got another thing coming, because there has been a lot of history gone into this project. There'll be a lot of political aggravation, a lot of ups and downs, a lot of squabbling, but it won't come to an end in a very quick way. And when it does suddenly come to some turbulence, it may well be in a way that nobody really has been very much predicting. Mm. I think it's like a long-running Raymond Chandler novel. You don't quite know who's going to be the hero and who's going to be the villain. And you suspect that there'll be blood on the carpet at the end of the novel, but you don't quite know whose blood, and you don't know who will be the victim, and you don't know whose will be the fingerprints in the dagger sticking out from between their shoulder blades. So it is like a long-running detective story, I would say, and may it run and run, I say.
All right. Our guest, David Marsh, his book is The Euro, The Politics of the New Global Currency, now available in paperback from Yale University Press. He's chairman of London and Oxford Capital Markets, a London-based corporate finance and investment company. He's also a writer-journalist. Mr. Marsh, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for your interest. All the best. Goodbye.